Oh, yeah. That's Mario Balzara and the Afro-Cuban Jazz Orchestra with Tanga, considered the first true Afro-Cuban jazz tune, and it remains one of the greatest Afro-Latin jazz hits of all time. Born in Havana, Mario Balzara, a renowned musician, composer, arranger, and bandleader, began performing with the Havana Philharmonic Orchestra at the age of 9, and he came to New York under a recording contract at the advanced age of 14. It was in New York that the jazz bug bit him, and he immersed himself in the Harlem jazz scene and developed his own unique style, merging jazz forms with Afro-Cuban rhythms. He died in 1993 in New York. He was 83 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Free Your Mind Friday, as you know. We wrap up the week of madness that we just climbed through, and we brace ourselves for even more madness in the week to come with the so-called Super Tuesday. And so I'm sure there's a lot to talk about. Programs that we discussed here, things that we discussed in our programs, and things of your own, thoughts and ideas and critiques and analyses that you have to offer, to put on the table, because, you know, this is about building community, and this is peer-to-peer education. This is what I love, the idea that we should use radio this way to connect people and connect people's thoughts. This way we get different appreciations for what's going on out there, and we get to see things from different points of view. So you know the deal, 888-874-4888 is the number to call. I'm expecting that you have something to say. And if you do, let's hear what it is. Also, be prepared. You know, we have very sharp listeners, and they tend to, pick up from where you leave off. And sometimes it's about challenging certain things, but always with great respect and with great admiration, but always, again, with great individuality. I love that. I really do. So 888-874-4888, let's get started. And Joel is up to bat first from New York.
Hi, Idris. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. So, I feel remiss in not really speaking about the financial and economic crisis that we're beginning to undergo right now. I really don't want to say very much about that, other than I think it's our obligation, those of us who are on the radical left, to keep talking about this and to mobilize and organize around it, because the suffering that's going to come is really going to be unimaginable. That said, I want to chime in on what you've been talking about, and one of the themes that I think has threaded a lot of your programs together this week, about the political season. And I'd like to say a few words about the Sanders campaign, Democratic Party, and corporate power, if I may.
Sure.
Okay. And, as we've watched the campaign now, it's his campaign has been going on for over half a year, and we've seen all of the numerous young, white college-educated supporters in his bid for the presidency. We hear him telling us that this is a movement that he's creating. He promises a political revolution. But it just seems to me that this rhetoric is an updated version of the change that was promised in the 2008 campaign of Obama, and even by Jesse Jackson's earlier National Rainbow Coalition campaigns that you alluded to in some programs this week. These Democratic electoral campaigns, I think of also of the campaign of Kucinich in 2004, that sort of thing. These campaigns at best raise political consciousness. There's nothing wrong with that, of course, but they do not become movements, and they do not engender revolutions. They exist as long as election campaigns endure, and then they vanish. And I don't think Santa's campaign is going to be any different. No movement, and, you know, that's what we need in this country. We need a movement, or political revolution will ever be built within the confines of the Democratic Party. And the repeated failure of so many American liberals to grasp this duplicitous game that's being played by these elites has really effectively neutered it as a political force. And, I think that history should count for something. The Democrats, like the Republicans, have no interest in genuine reform. They are wedded to corporate power. They are about appearance, not substance. You know, they speak in the language of democracy. We're even hearing that from Lady Macbeth now. Even liberal reform and populism. But they doggedly block campaigns.
Lady Macbeth.
What?
Yeah, you got me with the Lady Macbeth reference.
Oh, it's hard to see her in any other light. She's so duplicitous and deceitful, so hateful. God, I wouldn't want to be a friend of hers. Anyway, I didn't want to talk about her. I'm sorry I brought her up.
But let me ask you something here, yeah. Joel. Do you give Bernie Sanders any credit at all for sparking this movement that you say will not occur within the confines of the Democratic Party? I agree with you there. But do you see any sign at all that he's at least triggering or contributing to the formation of a movement, although it's in, you know, it's in a seminal stage?
Well, of course, that's the major question, isn't it? Sanders has said that if he doesn't receive the nomination, he's going to support the party nominee. He's not going to be a spoiler. And if that happens, he is going to become an obstacle to change. He will recite the mantra of the least worst, who will become part of the Democratic establishment's campaign to neutralize the left. The question is, what will happen to them? And I think of what has happened to insurgencies in the past. I remember just recently when Kucinich was running in 2004. Remember he got aboard that plane with Obama? And God knows what Obama said to him there, but he left the plane talking about Democratic unity. What happens to his supporters? So I think that Santa's supporters can expect a similar reception. Sanders has, you know, I've followed Sanders a long time because when I was much younger and raising my kid, I had a place in Vermont, in Wilmington, which is in the south of Vermont, and Bernie had just gotten elected mayor of Burlington. We heard about this guy from Brooklyn who's calling himself a socialist, who's just elected to Vermont's, you know, largest city. So I've been following him, and, you know, Sanders has made a kind of Faustian deal with a party. And he really served as one of the main impediments to building a viable third party in Vermont. And if Sanders defied the Democratic Party, he will be stripped of his seniority in the Senate. He'll lose his committee chairmanship. The party machine will turn on him, as it did Nader, into a pariah. It will push him outside the political establishment. So Sanders probably saw the fact that he ran as a Democrat because he recognized what happened to Nader as political reality, but it's also an admission of cowardice, and it leaves everyone on the lurch. And so what we have to do, because he's going to be up there, you know, raising the hand of Clinton and telling us to unite so that you can't imagine what's going to happen after these conventions. The campaign of fear is going to be like anything, unlike anything we have ever seen in American political history. I really mean it.
So let me ask you, left that you're talking about, where is it? Is there a left?
Well, you know, there are lots of community I'm not talking about the kinds of community organizations that Booker T. Obama was involved with, because he was really working for real estate companies in Chicago. But there are so many radical organizations that are out there on a neighborhood basis. They're in every city, they're in every hamlet, they're there, but they're just not organized. That's why you asked before what about the Sanders phenomenon? After all, Sanders is nothing more than a liberal Democrat with a hardcore imperialistic view of foreign policy. So he's like Hubert Humphrey. He's even to the right of George McGovern in many ways. I'm not saying that some of the things that he's calling for are bad, but we're beyond the moment of incremental reform. Not when you have a 45% poverty rate in the United States, and when 20% of children in this country are food insecure. We're beyond reform. We need radical change, and we need it now. So what we need to do, we need an interracial coalition. We need to support all those radical groups that are, I used to vote Green for many, many years, and I'm still going to vote for Jill Stein. She's the only rational candidate running. On the other hand, the Green Party is, well, she's rational, you know. She's the only one who's talking about the ice melts in the Antarctic, the Arctic, and Greenland. She's the only one talking about the desertification of the West, destruction of the economy there. She's the only one talking about the militarization of police and the exacerbation of racism in our country. So I'm going to vote for her, but she can't win. And the whole point of politics, Teresa, then I'm going to get off. But the whole point of politics, and I've been saying this again and again to the point of redundancy on your program, is not to try to win elections. If this was the pre-1914 America, when there were some 30 or 40 socialist mayors, we could all run on a socialist plank, you know, and we would get a lot of votes. I mean, Eugene Debs got almost 1 million votes when he was in jail in 1912 when he ran for the presidency. But we don't have that now for a whole variety of reasons, which I can't talk about. The political left has been decimated. But what we can do is recognize that it's our job now not to win elections, but to create movements. And when we run for political office, we're there to create movements. And that, and movements have to be, you know, they require everyone coming together in a kind of popular front. That was the language of the 1930s, fighting fascism. We're fighting a different kind of fascism now. And we need to unite. And it has to be an interracial coalition and a transnational coalition. That's why I thought, by the way, that some of those kids in Ferguson who reached out to Palestinian teenagers during the crisis 6 or 7 months ago, that was an incredible thing. And we have to not only sustain efforts like that, but continue them as well.
Exactly. Thank you, and amen to that. Okay. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Trees, how's it going?
Great. How are you?
All right. Wanted to also say congratulations. Gary had mentioned you on his show, saying that you were completing another phase of your workout or recovery.
Yeah, I am. I'm on to phase two.
Yes, congratulations, and I hope you stay around for a very long time.
Thank you so much, and I publicly commend and thank Gary as well, and many others for the good thoughts and the guidance. It's helped me a lot, and it continues to help me every day. So what's on your mind today? How are you freeing your mind today?
Well, you know, I haven't talked much about or haven't discussed much about the political race that's going on with the presidency, because it's really making me sick to my stomach. I mean, Bernie Sanders is probably the only one I can tolerate, but even to a point, I'm kind of like, you know, side-eyed at him as well. But I know you and some other people on your show, you know, talk about the option of not voting. And, you know, the one thing that I put on it is, in my opinion, now I'm still going to vote, but I don't admonish people who don't vote because of the fact that I totally understand. I mean, the political system is all messed up and broken, and I can understand why. But I feel, to me, that, you know, I still vote, and not because of the cash lines that people say about, well, you know, our ancestors fought to vote. But the thing with me is that I think my disapproval of voting, my disapproval of the political system gets out when I vote, because when I vote, the last couple of elections, I've been writing in candidates. I've been writing in myself, actually. So, you know, I do a write-in, and that's my disapproval and discontent of the political system. And, you know, you get the normal, well, you know, you shouldn't do that. You're wasting your vote. There's no such thing as wasting a vote.
Well, I tell you what I say. I made my decision a long time ago. I will not vote unless, this is what I always say, unless there is a compelling reason to vote, I will not vote. Mm-hmm. I haven't found a compelling reason to vote in at least 15, 20 years.
and I understand. I mean, you're absolutely
I'm not
right
telling
there.
People don't vote. I'm saying my decision was, unless I could determine that there is a compelling reason for me to vote, my name is Bennett, and I ain't in it.
Well, you know, and also, too, you were talking about, you also talked about Jesse Jackson and his campaign for presidency in the mid-80s. Well, you know, it's so funny when you talk about that, I also think about his activities with the Harold Washington campaign before he started running. And I think a lot of what he did in his presidential campaign, he took the template from the Harold Washington campaign because, you know, the one thing is that Jesse was a very, you know, he was a very supportive voice in registering a lot of Chicagoans to rally for Harold Washington and to vote. And I think he took that template and used it in his presidential race. And like you said, I think it was a huge success. And to look at it like this, because what you say, and I totally agree with you, the Democratic Party needs to be destroyed. And I think the first place that the Democratic Party needs to be destroyed is here in Chicago, because this city is the Democratic stronghold. And I think if we can get somehow, some way, whether it be a third party, whether it be blacks not voting for the Democratic Party here, I think it needs to start here in Chicago. And I think if you started here in Chicago, I think it'll spread nationally amongst, and you will see the discontent. Because, you know, going back to Harold Washington, you know, didn't take it on. He worked around the party and to his own agenda, because the one thing Harold didn't do was he didn't get any support from the Cook County or the Chicago Democrats when he was running. All of the money and all of the resources that he used to run his mayoral campaign was from the people. It was never from the Chicago Democratic machine, never from the Cook County Democratic machine. And I think that was one of the things that they were upset about with him, because he was a very independent man, you know, and he was very, you know, he was very smart man as far as politically as well. But Jesse did, like I said, I think Jesse took a lot of what happened in the Harold Washington campaign to his presidential race. And, you know, that's the one thing that we have to do. We have to modify it and see where we can go with that. But I think it's a very, you know, like you expressed before, it's a very important thing that we have to study, you know, politically.
Well, here's the thing. You have all kinds of models that exist out there that people have drawn from, and they may not necessarily have given credit or will give credit to these things, but, you know, before Harold Washington, before Jesse Jackson, there was Shirley Chisholm.
Mm-hmm.
But with respect to Harold Washington, I tell you, that is, and I've talked about him admiringly here, as a political tactician. He knew exactly how to organize and to mobilize a community in support, seemingly operating within the Democratic Party, but at the same time radicalizing the Democratic Party. Now, if you combine that strategy and you put it to work in Chicago, where you have a groundswell of opposition ready to go, the teachers' union, for example, most unions in Chicago are anti-Rahm Emanuel. The people are anti-Rahm Emanuel across the board. You take a trip right across the lake to Detroit, and you marry Chicago and Detroit, you have a nexus, a hub of serious potential here. You have all kinds of ways of building movements outside of the Democratic Party that could very successfully challenge the Democratic Party. But I think you have a good idea there, but it should be repeated all over the place. And there's no reason that we should be stuck in 2016 wondering where is it going to start. It has already started. The thing is, look at Ferguson, you look at Baltimore, you look at Washington, D.C., New York City. You look at the hubs across the country where people have begun to mobilize, and specific to the conditions that they are opposed to and the systems that are in play. And overwhelmingly, they are democratic. They're suffering terribly under democratic administrations that supposedly are so liberal. I don't see it. Yeah. So I think it's way past due that we got to get this together. And but I'm not at all without hope that it will happen. I see it happening. People are doing what they're supposed to do. What is needed in a way is a bit of education about how governmental systems work. I've long been an advocate for a kind of communiversity, for lack of a better term. I'm borrowing it, a popular term that's been used. People's university, community-type university, where you could learn how systems work. Mm-hmm. So you can organize effectively, more effectively against them. And we have to do that because I'm telling you what's coming. It's going to be serious. It's really serious. Yes. And they're not playing. This is for keeps now. This is where we are. But thank you so much, Henry, for your call today. Good to hear from you from Chicago. Thank you. From New York, Jay, you're on the air.
Yes, Beatrice, how are you, my sister?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
Good. Did you get a chance to see that magnificent dog and pony show yesterday?
No.
Say is a debate?
Nah. I tuned that out.
Yeah, I enjoyed it for the first 35 minutes, and I must say, it was quite comical to see grown men behave in the fashion in which they do and to try and pretend to be the future leaders of the so-called greatest nation in the world. Because if that's the best we have to offer, boy, we're in some real trouble as Americans going forward in the world.
Well, that's what I mean. We started the political season with that observation. If this is the best they've got, you know, there are nations all around the country perplexed that this nation is going to be in the hands of all of any one of these people contending for the nation's top office. It's to them bewildering, to say the least.
Well, I guess they would like to end the world, because I personally don't see any leader of the free world that has the same capacity of military might to put up with the shenanigans of Cruz, Trump, or Rubio, or even Hillary Clinton, because to be honest with you, I think she's more dangerous than those three are. Cruz is scary, but Hillary is the real true warmonger. But what I really wanted to say today is that we have to start looking at politics in terms of our local community. As someone who has lived in Harlem for over 50 years, to see the condition of Harlem at this time, after coming behind someone of the nature of Adam Clayton Powell, to then having this total disgrace in Charlie Rangel, we have to figure out what we're going to do as a people to deal with these local issues. Because to me, I think the local issues are becoming more important.
Well, here's the thing. You point to Harlem, and it's a sore spot for me, because I've been railing against the situation in Harlem for decades. Here's the problem.
I'm living it.
The problem is, too, it's not just the lack of effective leadership. The problem is the unwillingness or the disinterest of the people themselves to take control of their community. It is really very, very upsetting. And this pattern is repeated. People elect people to office and then they sit back thinking, well, you know, you'll do whatever needs to be done. You'll take care of business. No, it's still your business. It is your community. And when your schools are being shut down, when your hospitals are being shut down, when you have, you know, so many unemployed people, when you're there's no new housing being built, there, you know, you have these conditions that are key to just a basic quality of life. And we see no movement by the people. They just say, well, you know, somebody else's job to fix it. No, it isn't.
Please, that's not happening on that level in Harlem. Schools are not closing down. Hospitals are not closing, really.
I could point you, you live in Harlem, you go to 8th Avenue and 126th Street. There is a school that is now a luxury condo. How did that happen?
Patrice, what I'm trying to say to you is, yes, that happened, but there was two or three other schools that were built a couple of blocks away. What I'm saying and what I'm observing is,
but they're not public schools. They're not public schools. The schools that are being built are charter schools.
Public and charter. Right, but the thing is, they're more or less public schools in a sense that kids are not having to really go through a lottery like it was back in the day with charter school. Charter schools in New York are being run a little different. But the thing I'm trying to say is that gentrification has came in with the help and assistance of the politicians that didn't do anything to protect the indigenous Harlemites who were there.
And the community in turn rewarded it by keeping electing them. I just don't get that. That's the problem I'm saying. We have to stop that pathology. We have to put these folks out of our misery. When you elect an official, and then you step back and you see all the things that are going on in community, you do nothing. And then you say, well, it's them to blame. No, it's not. It's shared blame here. And ultimately, the people of the community have to bear a serious percentage of the responsibility for the direction of their community, which way it's going to go. Thanks so much for your call today, Jay. From Alabama, Kerwin, you're on the air.
I love your show, and I love everything you're doing. My brother, he's the one that put me on. My brother's Kamal. He works with the UAM on Leonography.
Oh, yes,
that's my brother. He's the one that put me onto your show, and I listen to it. Even on my work, I listen to it here and there.
Thank you so much.
Yes, you're welcome, Beatrice. It's just that I think that what we have to start doing is, like, a lot of the so-called Negroes, we just have to disassociate ourselves from them because they're not going to fight for anything. They're not going to side with us for anything that's for our own good. And like you were saying before, it's not their fault, because if we have to have enough assertive black manhood and assertive black womanhood to let these people know that if we're not going to get what we're supposed to have in our society, because everything in this world belongs to everybody. It doesn't belong to one person or to one individual or no group of individuals. And what we have to do is that we have to disassociate ourselves from the people, because they're not going to fight with you. Look what Arthur Maddox have done all these years. He's in the trenches fighting. Nobody's going to get in the trenches and fight with him, but they're going to sit on the sidelines and either criticize him, or either what they're going to do, they're going to go to the enemy and side with the enemy against him. So we don't need all of that. I'd rather go to a war with five people that's going to fight with me than 1,000 cowards that's going to run. And it's going to be a hard situation, because there's not going to be many of us. You have to understand that. And these people that are so-called be out in the community, yes, they're black, and yes, we love them, but now you're not our open enemy. We know who our open enemy is, the Europeans. But now you've become the BI enemy because you're siding with the Europeans, and you don't have enough courage to stand up for not only for your rights, but the rights of the ancestors that came before us and the offspring that's going to come after we're leaving here. So, you know, and it's a hard situation, you treat, because everywhere you go, like I'm down here, I'll be up in New York soon, but even down here and up there, everywhere you're going, people, they're not willing to fight. They want people to fight for them. They want people to hand them something on a silver platter. But when it comes to getting in the trenches, they're not going to get in the trenches with you. They're going to run. So what do we really need them for? Because they're not, you know, it doesn't matter how many numbers they are. It could be 20,000 of them. They're not going to sit there and fight with us for anything substantial, anything that we need, and therefore we have no reason even to side with them. Or then when we do have a victory, we don't need them to come in when we have a victory. We need them when we're trying to fight for a victory.
Well, thank you for that. There's no argument against that from me, that's for sure, because it's something I've been railing about for decades. The fact that people think that this is a, you know, struggle is up to one person or a small group. It's the same faces you see all the time. You go to meetings, you see the same faces all the time. The small group carrying everybody else. It's got to stop. Thank you, Curran, for calling. From Philadelphia, Clara, you're on the air.
Hello, Latrice. Good to talk with you and also the rest of the people in the audience.
Thank you.
I think a lot. Of course, I have time because I'm old and I have time to do that and study a lot more than most people. And what I'm coming up with now is the fact that one of the problems we have, not only in the black community, but the community at large, is the absence of elders. We have many old people, people who have just grown old. But we've lost the power of elderhood. So I've been studying that and working with, talking with other people. I talk with people mainly in their 60s because they're headed in my direction. And I think it ties in with what we've been talking about on your show and what you've been leading us up regarding. And that is the need for personal responsibility, which goes into family responsibility and then into community responsibility. And I think, I'll give you an example. You know, I think if I can get, I talk with people in their 60s and they listen. You know, we have conversations about health and about all kinds of things. And then I get into how can we develop awareness in our own families. And a couple of women have gone out and started gardens, and they're going to be teaching in the garden, starting with their grandchildren, and then their children come in. But a good example is of what I've been doing and what many of us could do. When I was in my 60s, is when I began first to really focus very keenly and strongly on my health. And now at 81, I'm healthier than I was at 50. And that can be done by people. It's a slow, concentrated effort. But we didn't get into this situation overnight. And it relates to strength in the community. I think I agree with many of the people who've called in. We turn our attention inward and then work out within the community, within ourselves, within the family, within the community. And as we do that, I feel more powerful. You can become so much more powerful. You save money, you strengthen your health, you educate, you build community. And it's done gradually and in a concentrated way. A year ago, when my grandson and his girlfriend turned 27, I turned 81. And I looked at them and they said, oh, you're doing so well. I said, look, you're 27. Aging begins at 27. Well, they didn't like that. A year later, they write me a note. Thank you. You made us aware of the things we need to do now. So it's just an example of what we as elders can do for our young people. And it's not just in health, but that reverberates into everything else.
Well, could you give us an example of how you did that, how you continue to do that?
Well, it started in my 60s. I got very ill. I was a lifelong asthmatic. And it had gone away, and it came back in my 50s. I almost died. And then, it was around that time, or a little earlier, I began to listen to Gary Noll. And then I started reading about health. And then, little by little, I became aware, gradually, of this toxin, sugar. Then that toxin, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, wheat. Then these other toxins about 4 years ago, dairy. It's ongoing. But in the meantime, being a role model for my children and other people I meet. I have friends in my 60s, in their 60s, who gravitate toward me and say they want to do things the way I do them, so they, when they get my age, they'll be vibrant. And then they tell people in their 40s. So they're empowered through action and modeling, like you are.
Thank you. Well, it's a very sobering thought, and it is something that should come to us much earlier than it usually does, the recognition that in many ways we can fix things if we become aware of the consequences and start doing things differently. That would help preserve our health, because in the end, it's the one thing that you if you're blessed with it, you have an abundance of riches. So it is a very, very sobering thought that you offer today, and I thank you for sharing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chase.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. New Jersey, Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, Chase, and hello to the PRN audience.
Thank you.
I hope you're well and continue to thrive and heal and get better.
Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it.
You know, I have just a small point to make. You know, last night I watched a little of the debate, and it seemed horrendous to me. And also with Hillary and all that, I don't know why, you know, we say we need to make changes, and why are we wedded to tradition in the political sphere? Why must we continue these traditions of electing individuals who are not individuals at all, who are just, you know, conformists, really, and just mechanical speakers, and they could be, you know, so easily twisted to, you know, by different forces. Why can't we get away from politicians altogether? Why are we wedded to the idea of leaders and followers? When we know leaders destroy followers and followers destroy leaders, why can't we just have, look, if I elect a Hillary Clinton or a Bernie Sanders, suppose they're, God forbid, but suppose they're in office 3 months and they have a heart attack. Now you got all excited about this individual, this personality, this Bernie, this one, Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and they become we have this worship of personalities, and then the conflicts, you know, and they're sniping at each other. It's like a clown show, these kind of debates. I don't know if you watch them, but...
I refuse to. Yeah, I mean, I got the general gist of things really, really early. I announced on this program what it's all about. It's a dog and pony show. I don't mean to sound, you know, boastful or anything like that, but I just can't take the nonsense.
Yeah, well,
I operate at a different level, and I just can't. I refuse to have them drag me down to theirs. I'm just not going to do it. So I don't watch this stuff.
I mean, but it's a phenomenon to watch, Utrice. When you see it, it's worse than you can imagine. This is sophomoric. It's like high school students up there. And high school students debate, they do much better.
Well, what you're seeing is really a bunch of very average people intellectually. They're very average, but they have been brought into legitimacy by a compliant media.
Now, why
and media is treating this as a reality show. It's a reality show.
It's
and
silly.
Conjuring up a very dangerous idea of what our reality is, expecting us to go along with it. And no, that's not my reality, and I refuse. I mean, I watch it from time to time because it is important to get an idea of where, just how low they're sinking and what it means for me. So we have to keep tabs on it. But in terms of looking at this election cycle as something particularly meaningful or something particularly awe-inspiring, no, it isn't.
Yes, but why must we go year after year, every 4 years, every 2 years, and look for these individuals who are not individuals at all? There's no wisdom in them or anything. They're businessmen. They're they're politicians who think they're businessmen. There are businessmen who think they're politicians. They're totally confused. And we have to support confused people. This is beyond.
Well, let me ask you, Michael, what, therefore, you're asking a rhetorical question. What do you think is the answer?
I'm going to suggest something, Eutrice. I suggest that people move away from this whole tradition of electing individuals and people, and instead just form groups that make policy positions that we agree to live in under these policies. And the policies have to be based on values, and the values have to come from wise individuals, wise people who hold welfare as the highest principle, human welfare, the welfare of people as the highest principle, and from there make policies based on that. Otherwise, it's completely egocentric. It's you're gonna be electing egos to anyway, if somebody dies after 3 months, right, then you say the vice president is going to follow the policies of the guy who died. Then they're going to, you know, make him as some kind of an ascendant, you know, saint or god, the person who died, and the next person is going to be, you know, follow his policy. Well, so the individual wasn't important really because, you know, they're not there anymore, but the policies are supposed to be important. But in the end, with these individuals and holding office and everything, then they're just twisted by the powers that be, the economic powers, because it all comes down to money. And it's much easier to twist an individual politician than it is to affect the policies. You can't affect that. You can't twist it. So my suggestion is to look for ways to get these individuals that are not individuals at all, who are just confused people. First of all, if you want to get up there and lead everybody, you're confused right from the beginning, as far as I'm concerned. So get away from electing these individuals who are obviously confused, obviously influenced, obviously corrupted, and they'll say anything and do anything. So get away from that and just have groups of people form policies, and you vote for the policies. Okay, so you have, here's the ego policies, the me policies, who want to be rich, 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 and they want, you know, they want all these things, you know, that are, you know, what I can have and possess and grab, 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 like Donald Trump, and more and more and more. And then you have these other people who put together a group of policies that are based on the welfare of human beings. And you say, well, vote. You could vote for the ego policy of me, 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 and you, and they, and we're going to bomb them. It's me and them, right? It's the blacks and the whites. It's the Jews and the Arabs. It's the Germans and the French and the Puerto Ricans and this one and that one, completely fragmented, and we're all egotistically going to fight one another. Or you could say, here's a plank of policies based on humanistic values, based on the welfare of human beings. Now, I think I'm the only one on your show that's come on from day one and said the word welfare, because the word welfare has been made into a dirty word. But what higher value can there be than welfare, than the welfare of the people? What's best for the people? But nobody says it, because we're all supposed to be egotistical. Me, 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 and what can I get, and where can I position myself?
The notion of rugged individualism is deeply enshrined in the so-called American values.
Well, it's egotism.
Well, it's worse than that. It's annihilation. It's a form of annihilism. People say, it's all about me, nothing about you. Thank you, Michael, for bringing this to our attention today. Our last caller, Willie from New York. You're on the air.
Beloved, how are you?
Fine, thank you, Willie. How are you doing?
I'm okay, my sister. Here's my concern. You know, I agree with the last caller and quite a few callers, but the first caller, I disagree with the part where he said that there's not a movement. That's not correct. We have the biggest movement there ever was, and that movement is PRN. It is up to us to make it bigger, each one of us. You see what I'm saying? Because every day as a part of my life, the information you guys are providing, I have to share it with somebody. That's my job. And not only that, finance the station also. With Mr. Trump, that was in the hospital, and Sister Yutis, my pressure went up. I was in the doctor's office. I put the one out.
Well, the good thing is you were already in the hospital.
my pressure went up. Because since 1990, I haven't watched television. Because I know the games they play. I wasn't a part of it. And when I saw the react, I was in the back of the waiting room, and I saw this. I said, my God, I don't believe this. But there's a concerted effort to dumb down the American people. You have to know that. And the people who control it, when I saw them, Trump, 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 I said, oh, my, I can't believe this. It's like a game. A game show, a football game or something like that. Trump, Trump. But I blame it on the media because they're not saying who Trump fathers. I mean, Gruff. Mr. Gruff, you did a program on it. When I saw those people jumping around, I said, if they knew who he really was, I wonder if they'd be Trump, Trump, Trump. I wish they knew. And for the kind of bigotry and the hatred and the divisiveness, this guy should be ran out of America. That kind of talk, you know, they're about the men in the borders.
Yes.
People are getting killed because of these people. People are getting, and that's kind of rhetoric you're talking when you too is an immigrant. Now, first of all, California, Colorado, Texas, and Nevada, it is not. It is Mexico. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They're not no immigrants. They're Mexicans coming home. That's all. And for you to demonize and discredit and disrespect nations, think about this. You know, it's a frightening time for me. Very frightening. Because none of them, I would ever give my vote to. But I've always voted now, and I'm going to vote. But none, I'm going to write Minister Farrakhan's name in. And the reason for that is very simple. Because the people who control the minds of America, I know who they are, and I know what they're doing to the American people, because the American people, they're very good people. They're very generous people. And if they know the truth, they will do the right thing. And the way they demonize him and discredited that brother, and you nowhere in his speech you could find that kind of racist, bigot, and hateful as Mr. Trump. Why don't they speak on that? Look at how they have demonized that brother based on a lie. So why don't they let the American people know the truth about what's going on? But for me, Utrecht, it is up to us, the people listening to PRN. We have a revelation put in place, and it's led by brother Gary and Sister Utrecht and the producer at PRN. It is up to us, the listeners, to put the word out. Because if every one of us do five, six people a day, and people will thank you, because people will say, wow, I text people certain programs, and now I have people calling me and texting me. As a matter of fact, the media, you're making a change in the media right now, whether you know it or not, because I've been listening to that other station. And I said, wow, they're addressing certain issues that the way it should be dealt with, simply because you did it. And all I have to say, it's up to, you know, I'm not very articulate, you know that. But I wish I could say the things as articulate as other people. But it is up to us. We could change this thing around. In America, the voice of the people should be PRN, because once they begin to get the truth and begin to understand how it works, they will change. Not only, just not just PRN. For example, we have a Freedom Party in New York, started by Alton Maddox. We join every organization that's progressive. That's how I do it. You know what I'm saying? It don't have to be one thing you do, but any organization that's progressive, you join, you help fight financially, you invite people, that kind of thing.
Thank you, Willie, for your admonition today. And thank you so much for doing all you can to promote PRN and this program as well. Thank you so much for your call today. I greatly appreciate it.
Can I say one more thing, please?
I'm sorry?
Can I say one more thing?
Quickly, because we are at the end.
It doesn't have to be big money. But everybody, please finance the station, because we pay so much for television, cable. We could send 10, 15, whatever you can send. The finance station, because we own this. Thanks to Gary. I love that. Well, he's not a brother, he's an angel. Thank you, Chief.
Thanks a lot, Willie. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. It's a great note to end on, supporting PRN, a program that supports you and provides information that allows you to make greater sense of our reality. Thank you so much for listening today and for contributing, especially at such a high level, a consistently high level. I greatly appreciate that. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus, and he calls it as he sees it with regard to the economy, the global economy. You can reach me always at leadstories@gmail.com. I'm doing my best to catch up with correspondence, but I really do appreciate hearing from you. I thank you always for your good thoughts and prayers and your good wishes, and I encourage you to do the same this weekend. Connect with people who bring positive dimension to your life. Absolutely, absolutely eject anybody or anything that is negative. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other Monday. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.